This is Chef John Bowles welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio, and inviting you to join us at the kitchen table for another hour of adventures in food. Each week, we travel from the back roads of Louisiana to the streets of Europe's capitals, delving into food. We talk with chefs, food historians, authors, and producers. We search out current trends, revive forgotten traditions, and naturally, we're going to turn the stove on for you. Being president of the United States does come with perks. Having the most delicious food prepared by the best chefs is surely one of them. Join me, Chef John Bowles, and Chef Roland Mesnier, White House executive pastry chef for 25 years, as we talk about cooking for presidents on Stirring It Up next. But first, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Talks between Syria's government and the opposition ended today without finding a way to break the impasse in the ongoing peace efforts. UN mediator Lakhdar Brahimi ended discussions after less than a half hour. He says the well-being of the Syrian people should be a top priority of all parties involved in the peace talks in Geneva.
My message to everybody who is involved in this terrible crisis is to think of the Syrian people, to think of the immense suffering that have been imposed.
There is no set date for future talks. After 4 days of deliberations, a jury in Jacksonville, Florida, says it's deadlocked on whether 47-year-old Michael Dunn is guilty of murder in the 2012 shooting of teenager Jordan Davis. NPR's Greg Allen reports the judge has asked jurors to go back and try again.
It began as a dispute over loud music. Dunn, who's white, was parked alongside an SUV with Davis and three other African-American teenagers inside. After he asked them to turn down their loud music, Dunn says Davis threatened him and began to get out of the SUV holding a shotgun. No other witnesses saw Davis get out of the car, and no weapon was found. Dunn shot and killed 17-year-old Davis, but is claiming self-defense. This afternoon, the jury said it had reached a verdict on charges of attempted murder and shooting into a vehicle, but was deadlocked on whether Dunn was guilty of murder. Judge Russell Healy sent them back to try to reach consensus on the murder charge. Greg Allen, NPR News.
The Obama administration's health care website hit another roadblock today. Officials say it won't be able to process new customers for several days. NPR's Laura Sullivan has more.
The problem this time isn't Health and Human Services' fault. This latest delay stems from the Social Security Administration, which is doing routine maintenance on its own computer systems. Officials say with Social Security down, healthcare.gov won't be able to verify applicants' information. The administration is making a big push at the moment for March enrollments. HHS already reported a 53% increase in applicants last month compared to the previous 3 months. More than 3 million people are now enrolled in health care coverage despite the initial problems that kept people from joining this past fall. Health and Human Services says this latest delay should be cleared up by early Tuesday morning. Laura Sullivan, NPR News, Washington.
Workers at a Volkswagen plant in Tennessee have voted against organizing as part of the United Auto Workers, saying they don't want to risk the future of the factory. Last night's vote was met with heavy campaigning on both sides. One worker who favored the union says he's not giving up on one day being represented by the UAW. This is NPR News. Another round of snow is pummeling parts of the East Coast this weekend. Forecasters say areas in New England could get up to 14 inches. New York City could also see several more inches of snow after getting buried earlier this week by a nor'easter. Dan Peterson is a meteorologist at the National Weather Service.
They'll probably have a little bit more north of the city where it's going to stay cold enough for snow, and they'll transition from rain to snow later today and tonight across New York City and Long Island. So probably a few inches to four in that area.
Utility crews in South Carolina and Georgia are working to restore electricity to tens of thousands of homes who lost power after this week's snow and ice storm. At the Winter Olympics in Sochi today, Team USA met Team Russia in hockey. The game went into overtime and then a dramatic shootout. NPR's Robert Smith reports from Olympic Park.
Russia and USA went hard from the start, and they were almost perfectly matched. As Russian President Vladimir Putin looked on, the teams traded goals back and forth. It was 2-2 in the third period when Russian Fyodor Tuten blasted a shot over the shoulder of USA goalie Jonathan Quick. The Russian crowd went nuts, but the refs said no goal because the net had moved off its mark on the ice. The game went into overtime, still tied, then a shootout. American TJ Oshie scored 4 times out of 6 tries, and the USA took the game. We're still in the preliminary rounds, so the two teams could meet again. Robert Smith, NPR News, Sochi.
When it comes to Olympic medal totals, Germany is leading with 7 gold medals. Switzerland is a close second with 5. The U.S. is tied with several countries with 4. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
For the finest in classic ska, rock steady, rockers, DJ, dance hall, and dub, it's Jamon. Cecil here, bringing you Southwest Louisiana's longest running reggae tradition, Jamon. Jamon Sunday nights from 9 to 11 p.m. or Saturday mornings from 1 to 3 a.m. and streaming live anytime at krvs.org.
Chef John Falls welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. All right, everybody, welcome to Stirring It Up. Welcome to the kitchen table. It's so nice to have you sitting here with us today, and I'd like to begin by welcoming Michelle Yark, our executive producer. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for asking. Well, I appreciate the concern.
Well, no problem at all. What's going on in your life? I hadn't seen you in a couple of weeks.
You hadn't seen me in a couple of weeks. That's because I've been working on a cookbook.
Have you?
Yes.
How's the cookbook coming? Huh?
Good, good. We're into antiquity now.
Into antiquity.
Yes, yes.
Our new
Egypt,
book.
Egypt, Greece, Rome.
Our new book on vegetables, huh?
That's right.
Hadn't come up with a name yet.
No name.
It's a no-name book so far, huh?
So far, it's the vegetable book.
Yeah, I was thinking about
that's it.
I thought the only name I came up with was searching out my roots. searching my roots. What do you think, huh? That's pretty good, I guess. Well, I think about that a little bit more. Normally.
I'm going to write that down on our ongoing list.
On our ongoing list, huh? Yeah. Anyway, y'all, it's so nice to have you. I have across the glass wall Dean Slime, our engineer, keeping the music and sound balanced and dynamic. What's going on over there, huh?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, you know, today is February the 15th. How's y'all Valentine's Day, huh?
It was good. Yeah. It was good. I had a good one.
You had a good
one? Kind of quiet.
Kind of quiet. What do you mean quiet, huh?
But what about I did get chocolate.
What about all that chocolate I gave you?
Well,
didn't I tell you I loved you yesterday morning when you came
yes,
to work?
Yes, you did. That was very nice.
I stood in the front door. Stood right there in the front door. I caught all the girls as they came in.
Mm-hmm.
I gave them my normal little three, you know, it's just a small box, but it's the thought that counts my cherry sips. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. But I like this quote. You can never be too rich or too skinny. Or have too much chocolate. I added the last part.
Yeah.
So if you want to give me some more, you can.
You added the last part.
No, I did.
Anyway, y'all, it's so nice to have all of you here with us today. We appreciate you stopping by. You know, Easter's. I mean, can you imagine Easter?
We got to get through Lent first.
Yeah, but Easter.
We're not anywhere close to Lent.
Yeah, but I got buffets to think about. I got dinners to think about. I got guests coming. I mean, Easter's right there. I mean, Lent just prepares me for the big day, you know?
And, you know, Easter and Mother's Day are only about 3 weeks apart this year.
I know.
Two or three.
It's good for retail. You know, it's really good for retail. That's all I got to say.
If everybody survives it.
Well, anyway, y'all, I thought it sounded a little embellished, that quote that Michelle just gave.
I liked that quote.
Well, yeah, but you added embellish with too much chocolate, but that's okay. It might be tough to keep the skinny part in line with all that chocolate you're talking about, but that's okay, too. You can afford it. Thinking of chocolate and considering that this is a President's Day weekend, it reminded me of the story Chef Roland Mesnier would tell about presidential sweet tooths, or teeth, I guess, during his 25 years of executive pastry chef work at the White House. He served under the administrations of Jimmy Carter all the way through to the younger Bush 43, and walked a fine line between satisfying the president's taste and not angering the first ladies. Like with a couple of our presidents who the first ladies really watched out for. You know what I'm talking about, huh?
You know, they had to make sure that they were having a healthy diet.
Like President Reagan I was talking about, you know. Yeah, his wife was very tight, you know. But men like sweets. We have sweet tooths, you know.
Well, and you know, some presidents were especially challenging, kind of like Bill Clinton. You know, under the Clinton administration, if you'll remember, there was a major White House food focus shift when the first lady, Hillary Clinton, replaced the executive chef with Walter Scheib.
Right, right.
She was very hands-on with the White House menus and wanted them to reflect the culinary heritage of America rather than having the French cuisine that the former executive chef had created. Of course, it really didn't matter to Bill much. You know, he was happy with McDonald's and having pizza delivery.
Well, and now look how times turn around. Bill is nice and lean. And Hillary is, she still looks nice. I'm not saying she doesn't look nice. I'm just saying the roles have reversed. Bill's real nice. I mean, he's running every day and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
What you looking at me for?
I'm just listening to you.
You think I ought to be careful about talking about ladies' weight, huh?
I think you should.
Well, even presidents have to eat, and they know what they like, needless to say. And I've had the pleasure of feeding a couple presidents myself, mm-hmm. including Clinton and including the Bushes. Now, you're not going to change anybody's diets there. There were those who were so absorbed in the country's affairs and troubles that they ate only out of necessity, like that lanky guy I'm thinking about, Abe Lincoln. He hated food. Food was a necessity to him, and that was it. It was inconvenience.
Andrew Jackson was the same. What did they call that stomach that he had? Couldn't take a lot of rich food.
Yeah, well, he had a lot of dysentery during the wars, and his stomach was always very weak. You know, it's sad that when the president, you know, preferred chicken fricassee, we're talking about Abe Lincoln, and corn cakes, but he'd often just pick on a little bit fruit at the table. But when you look at Abe Lincoln's stature, I mean, you can see that he probably wasn't a big, big eater. But as busy as he was, he planned his own inaugural luncheon menu, I might mention. That's right, a little mock turtle soup he had. Why mock? I have no idea. There was a lot of turtle.
There was a lot of turtle, yeah.
And, well, mock turtle soup was something that was in vogue then. Oh. You know, mock turtle, because turtle was an English dish, and I guess they wanted to do something mock that was more American. Corned beef and cabbage. That kind of seems like a lanky guy from the Midwest might be interested in a little corned beef.
And potatoes.
Parsley potato, a little blackberry pie with coffee. That was modest to say when compared to White House dinners of late, I might mention. Huh?
That's true. But we also had gourmet presidents, or those with gourmet tastes.
I can think of one, huh? Old Thomas Jefferson.
Well,
he lived in France for so long.
He did. He lived overseas and had kind of gotten spoiled on the European fare. He loved French cuisine, the daubes and the souffles. And then, of course, he fell in love with macaroni and the sharp cheeses of Italy and Holland. And when he tasted his first waffle, he liked it so much that he brought a waffle iron back to the U.S. with him. In fact, he quite often overspent his own presidential salary on food and wine and nifty little gadgets that he couldn't help but to purchase.
Oh, he was the first big foodie of America. Anyway, you know, you always cutting up about my Waffle House breakfast. Is it now? You see, Thomas Jefferson brought waffle irons back with him.
Waffle House has Jefferson to thank.
He's got a picture of Jefferson in every restaurant.
Well,
it is the breakfast of presidents. The Jeffersonian style of eating, though, continued into the next administration under the close supervision of another woman who loved to eat. Love little cakes, Dolly Madison. She loved the little cakes. Probably one of the most famous of all first ladies, Dolly Madison. She was the quintessential hostess and loved large, lavish parties that were referred to as squeezes because there were so many people in the room. They said, let's go to our Dolly Madison squeeze.
Yeah, the Wednesday squeeze. She was diplomatic. She was exercising diplomacy through food because she'd bring everybody in. They could chit-chat, have a little something to drink, have a little something to eat, you know.
She was even at a party when the White House was burned, you know.
When
the English came in, after, you know, they had the big bombing of the fort and the Star-Spangled Banner was written and all that, and the English marched on Washington, and they were sitting down having a banquet at the White House, Dolly Madison and James.
She had planned, you know, they had planned a victory dinner.
Yeah, right.
They thought that the American forces would be victorious. They were not. The president wasn't home. He was out on the battlefield. Dolly was getting everything ready, you know, the spits full of roasted meats and the wines on the table.
Yeah, the table was already set. Yeah, 40 place settings of china was laid out there, right?
But then when she found out the British were coming, she had to dress as a farmer's wife, dressed in disguise, and rode on a carriage out of town.
Is that right?
And it was the British who enjoyed the dinner. The victory was theirs.
The victory was theirs. There's a lot of controversy about what happened on that particular day because, like I said, the British came, they walked in, the Madisons had jumped in a carriage to take out. Didn't she pull a picture of George Washington or something off the wall?
Well, she probably had one of the staff do that, but I don't know whose idea it was. And, I mean, history books vary. But anyway, yes, she made sure that the George Washington Stuart painting was removed from the frame.
Well, now, if you fast forward a century or so to the Franklin Roosevelt administration, 1939, that's when the King and Queen of England came to visit the White House, right?
They did. And First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt shocked a lot of people, kind of shocked me when I learned this. She served hot dogs.
She did a barbecue outside.
And I guess, you know, it was okay because the New York Times article, big article, King tries hot dog and asks for more. So it did surprise me to learn that, though, for obvious reasons. But, you know, especially, too, because when the Roosevelts moved into the White House, it was Eleanor who revamped the kitchen. She had it completely redone under the Works Project Administration.
No, that's absolutely true. In 1933, when FDR entered the White House kitchen was really outdated. It was unsanitary. The cupboards were dark. They were dirty. There were huge old-fashioned ranges in there. There was one big old gas range that was out of date. The sink still had wooden drains. Can you imagine that?
Oh, my gosh.
1933, wooden drains in the White House, and the refrigerator was one of those antique ones that we see that still had the wood inside of it. It smelled horrible, according to record. The electric wiring was so old in the White House that it was a fire hazard. Plus, it was written that there were roaches running all around the White House kitchen. They rebuilt the whole kitchen, bringing it up to modern standards of the day with 6 roasting ovens, a 16-foot-long stove, 8 refrigerators, dishwashers. Mm-hmm. Modern appliances were added. Jefferson would have been pleased because they even added some nice electric waffle irons.
And what do they serve? Hot dogs.
Well, hot dogs because they wanted to show the King and Queen of England that, you know, we were a casual people here, and even the president could have like a little outdoor function, a little picnic function, and roll out the barbecue pit. So, yeah, it was kind of funny that he did that, but they liked it. Fact is, there were some nice articles written about behind the scenes of that particular dinner when the queen said, "Hot dogs. Are you kidding me? Hot dogs for the King of England?" And he told her to basically keep your mouth shut. Anyway, y'all, Roosevelt's cook, you know, really put that kitchen to work, too, because they prepared in the kitchen, you know, even one of our good New Orleans dishes, gumbo zab, you know, things like that. Anyway, the whole deal about the White House, the food preparation in the White House, until this period of the 1930s, right prior to World War II, food was just not that important from the time Jefferson left to the time of this.
Yeah.
We'll be right back, y'all.
Ready to hold steady for a kiss he'll plant. The Secret Service makes me nervous and I can't. They're always spying, no denying. They're always peeping, gumshoe creeping, private eyeing. When I'm beginning to give inning like a maiden egg. The Secret Service makes me nervous, and I can't. I've been exposed beyond control, just like a gold.
Greetings. I'm Jake Hebert.
And I'm Adam Chouard. Join us every Friday at midnight for the Sound Club radio program.
Your home for left-field pop gems from today to yesteryear.
Here on 88.7 FM, KRVS.
Hi, I'm Pete Bergeron. If your day starts early, like mine does, let's spend it together with Cajun music from 5 to 7 a.m. here at Public Radio for Acadiana, KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio, the best cultural show on radio, and we thank you so much for joining us at the kitchen table today with your cup of coffee in hand and your hopefully good piece of pastry next to you, because we have a very, very good friend and a very interesting guest who I know you're going to absolutely love. And Michelle, I'm going to give you the pleasure of introducing my friend here.
Thank
or
you.
Our friend, I should say.
Absolutely. Indeed, he's a very special guest who has firsthand knowledge of presidential tastes. So I'd like to officially introduce everyone to Chef Roland Mesnier, executive pastry chef for the White House from 1979 to 2006, the longest tenured chef ever to serve at the White House. Chef Mesnier grew up in a small village in France and achieved heights many only aspire to. As pastry chef at the Savoy Hotel in London and the Hotel George V in Paris, to corporate pastry chef for Princess Properties in Bermuda, and later executive pastry chef at the Homestead in Virginia, he has certainly, certainly made his mark. As I said, in 1979, he began as White House executive pastry chef, and in between creating desserts for presidents and their families, kings, queens, international guests, and dignitaries, he actually developed the first professional pastry arts program in Maryland. He's won over 25 medals of honor, including the French Legion of Honor Award, and was awarded the Doctorate of Culinary Arts from Johnson & Wales University. He's been a guest on the Today Show, CBS, NPR's All Things Considered, and now, once again, on Stirn It Up to add to his resume. Chef Mesnier, welcome to Stirn It Up. We are honored, honored, honored to have you with us today.
Thank you, thank you. It's a great pleasure for me to talk to all my friends in New Orleans and beyond. It's always a great pleasure to be on your show, and I know you have some interesting questions for me.
We always do, Roland, but I want to start off by saying that first of all, let me say I miss you, and I want to say a bon année. I want to say a happy new year to you. I know,
yes.
You have a great year ahead of you. You're always so busy, my God, ever since you left the White House and got onto your entrepreneurship. Bring us up to date a little bit. What all are you involved with now? Being the longest tenured pastry chef or chef at the White House, that's a hard act to follow, but yet, as in typical Roland Mesnier fashion, you've certainly been able to achieve dreams beyond your imagination. What's going on right now in your life?
Well, you know, Chef John, there is life after the White House. Many people don't believe that. They think, oh, my God, I've been to the top of the mountain. Now, where do I go? Well, you know, I reinvented myself totally by becoming a speaker and an author. Don't forget, I have 5 books out there. I'm a consultant really around the world. I've done consulting in Russia and then China. Now I'm involved with a large company in China I do their commercial on TV, believe it or not. For some of you who may travel to China, please turn on CCTV, which is the national chain, television chain, and you will see me there doing commercial for that company. This is one of the biggest food firms I've ever seen. They employ 72,000 people.
Oh, my gosh.
14 factory. Everything is done by machine. You can only buy their product by the container. You know those containers like you see on ship? That's the only way they will sell to you. Don't go call for 10 pounds of these or 5 pounds of that. They laugh at you. But, yes, it's an amazing business. It's been an honor and a pleasure to work with the Chinese people. They're very, very nice people. And they're really very serious in what they do. And they're hardworking people. I must say, you can always make it in life if you have the will to do so. And business keep going up and up and up. Recently, I even find out that my suite that I've created for them is selling in France, believe it or not. So my picture is on every boxes and everything, so you can't miss it. But, you know, the first thing people say when they see those boxes, I wonder who that handsome fellow is. That's the first question. Never mind what's in the box. You know what I'm saying?
That's why they put you on the box.
Well, you're right about that. You're quite a handsome fella, no doubt about that.
And with a French accent, you can't beat
that. Oh, yes. Oh, that's a win-win situation, Michelle.
And he served.
The lady just melted. That's all what there is to it.
I'm sure they did, just like a lump of sugar. Just like a lump of sugar.
Are you calling me a lump of sugar?
And he's always got chocolate in the pantry.
You see that?
Yes. You are right. You are totally right.
You see, he's a perfect ladies' man.
Yes. You know, you grew up in France, so that had to be a tremendous culinary experience. Tell us about that. Is that what got you into the food world to begin with?
Yes, yes. You know, I was so lucky to be from a very large family of 9 children, and one of my brother was a pastry chef. He's my older brother, a pastry chef. And I happened to spend a summer vacation with him. And that's really what got me into the pastry business. Now, you have to remember, Michelle, the difference from then to today. Those days, everything was done from scratch. We didn't buy anything, you see. So the pride is you had to be very proud of doing this job. Otherwise, nobody with the right mind wouldn't do it because it was so hard, you know. It was a very difficult, very demanding job. Today, I'm sorry to say, but most chefs buy everything already halfway made. Or already made. Or, you know, today, to be a good chef, you need a good box cutter. That's about the bottom line. which really annoyed me tremendously because I didn't come to my profession that I love so much for that. I came to this profession because I love to transform raw ingredient to something spectacular. And I think I've done that all my life. And there is no better job in the world if it's done the right way, you know. When you go to work in the morning, you are so excited to go there. And when you go home in the evening, you feel like the king on the hill for what you have created during the day and all the wonderful compliment people have paid you on what you have done. And this is why I became a pastry chef.
Well, you know, Roland, I think your exuberance, your excitement, just to speak of your business, to speak of from the heart of what you do and to do it with your hands and your mind and your eyes and then see the work, the creation that came out of nothing is really what's missing today because everybody going into the professions today, as you say, you open a box, you open a can, everything's done, you have no idea how it's made. Or do you think there's so much less pride in the work because you're not actually doing that much of the work?
Well, you know, John, I will blame television a lot for what has happened to our profession because they wanted to make this profession glamorous. Well, they made it glamorous. And they also made it a profession of nothing today. That's what they did. That's what came out of that. Because you cannot have it both ways. And as you know, John, you've been in the kitchen many, many years yourself. It takes hard work. It takes really commitment. It takes... You know, it's so many things that many compound to be good. But then, you know, you have created something you can be proud of, you see. Now, today, I think the pride is gone, number one. Number two, they put in the head of the young people that they can all be stars. They're all going to be a star. Maybe the star don't shine very well, but it's going to be a star.
Right,
and
right.
And that, I'm very sorry to say, has hurt our profession a lot. When I teach classes, I still do sometimes for special events and classes. This is the first thing I tell to the people. If you came to see me in hope to become a star, I want you to get the hell out of my room. That's very simple. Now, if you came to see me because you really want to do good food, then you're in the right place. This is what I have to say to the young people.
That's the passion that doesn't exist today. And, I mean, you and I got our start about the same time. I got into the kitchens in the 1960s and worked my way up to my own company. And like you, you know, work 7 days a week. I work, I can't even imagine the hours of my life I put in the kitchen. But, you know, every day I wake up and I look forward to doing my work. Every single day. Whereas most of the people, you know, at my restaurant Revolution in New Orleans, where we have one of the most magnificent kitchens you can see in any place in the country, all handmade, beautiful equipment. Sometimes I walk in and I look and I think, how many of my chefs, we have 35 culinarians in the kitchen every day, and I think to myself, how many of them realize what they have here? You know, how many of them are they just coming to make the dollar and then to get out the next day? So that's the passion. Now, what about when you first started, when you first went and knocked on the door of your first job in France? I mean, you started off with your brother, but then you went out on your own. Where was that at? Where was that beginning at before America?
Well, the start of my profession was in a small town in the east part of France called Besançon, near the Swiss border. And, you know, they were very rough. Those years were rough. I mean, I started at age 14 in the kitchen as an apprentice. And, you know, they expected you to put a day's work just like a man. Meaning starting at 6 o'clock in the morning, finishing at 9 at night. That was a day's work. They didn't cut you no slack, you know. You know, it's not like today, oh, my goodness, those poor little darlings, they're going to be tired, you know. We have to give them a break, and they need Coca-Cola break, and they need cell phone break. My foot, there was no break, okay? If the boss saw you doing nothing, said, what you doing? What do you think you're doing? Don't you have anything to do? I want to find you something to do. Scrub the floor over there. Look, he's dirty. You know, I mean, this is the way life was. That's how we were brought up. And you know what, John? I want to be honest, John and Michelle. If I had to do it again, this is how I would like to do it again, because this was so much pride in what I did. I cannot say how people can have pride in what they do today. They're all into work. They're still asleep. They, half of them, I don't know if their mind came with them or the mind went somewhere else. Unless you tell them exactly what to do, they're not going to do it. Nobody uses common sense. Where is common sense today? I don't know. That's a word they should strike out of the dictionary. Common sense does not exist anymore. You know, that's a whole dirty world.
They say that the kitchen is a place of pride, and what you're speaking of right now is days that were so tremendous. I mean, I was watching, Michelle and I, just the other day, we watched the movie Vatel. And we watched the movie Vatel, and let me tell you, I'm a person who at least twice, maybe three times a year, I watch the movie Vatel. Just because it reminds me of what a chef had to do to be the best of the best. And that is so far removed. If you ask 90% of the young culinarians today, who is Vatel, they never even heard the name.
Oh, they wouldn't know.
Michelle, you had a question about getting to the White House.
Well, yeah. I mean, you obviously came to America. What, did you have other jobs first, or did you just go and knock on the White House door and say, here I am?
No. When I came to the White House, I could have called myself a chef then, because I already had 20 years experience, almost 20 years experience in different hotels. And you know, I always selected where I work as a young man because I wanted to be the best that there was then, because I wanted to learn the top, the best food. How can you judge good food if you never had or never saw good food? That's impossible. And that's where we are today, by the way. Most of them have no idea what the food used to be made of and how it used to be made and how it used to be served. So, no, when I came to the White House, I was a pastry chef that had been already halfway around the globe.
You had come from the homestead there, right?
Well,
you
had the homestead. The homestead, and I also was a special consultant to the Greenbrier Hotel for many years. I also was at the George V in Paris as pastry chef, the Savoy in London, the Princess in Bermuda. I mean, a long list of hotels that were doing exquisite work, and the chefs were all absolutely over-the-top people, and they were very strict people. And I love strict in a kitchen. You cannot run a kitchen by being a softie. That doesn't work. You have to kick bottom, you know? That's how you run a kitchen. Otherwise, forget it. They take advantage of you. So you need to run a kitchen like you run an army. It's the same thing.
That's why they call it a brigade. They call it a brigade.
That's right. And the chef is the general.
How were you made aware that the White House job was available 25 years ago?
And what was that first interview like?
You know, you have to understand, I am one of the few chefs that turned down the job 3 times. You know, most chefs would give an arm and a leg. I turned the job down until they tricked me. Until one day, Mrs. Carter's secretary called me and asked me to come for a tour. Said, Chef Holland, I know you want to visit the White House, don't you? Why don't you come for a tour? I said, okay, I will do that. So those days, I was at the homestead, of course. To travel from the homestead to the White House by the road we had then was over 4-hour drive. And, you know, I was driving such a wonderful car those days. You remember the whole Dodge Dart? avocado color? They used to call my car the avocado, by the way, wherever we went. They said, did you drive the avocado today? I said, I surely did. But anyway, I drove right into the White House gate with the avocado. They let me in those days. I parked under the colonnade. Yes, the avocado was actually parked right under the colonnade.
Oh, my God.
And when if you step into the building and then met everybody. And, of course, later on they wanted me to meet Mrs. Carter, which was not at all planned. You know, that was not in the car. They didn't tell me that, so they tricked me. But Mrs. Carter, I must say, she was the loveliest lady. I tell you, she was grand. She was fantastic. She was absolutely fantastic. The entire Carter family was very nice people. You know, it hurt me when the press, you know, tore them down many times, and I do not like that one bit. And anyway, but yes, this is when the job was offered to me.
And even though you had turned the job down 3 times before, what made you decide at that moment that it was the right thing?
Well, you know, meeting Mrs. Carter changed a lot because she was so nice. And, you know, Mrs. Carter liked me, I could tell. Well, I understand why. I was the cutest guy that came for the job, you know. So that did a lot. That had a lot to do, you understand. You know, but, you know, she was really, really very, very pretty lady. Mrs. Carter, in her young age, was quite a looker, too, you know.
Well, yeah, well, she was a beautiful Southern girl.
Oh, she was very, very nice, yes. Yeah. And that's what changed my mind. I said to myself, well, maybe I do it for 5 years, you know. Then I get out of here, you know, 5 years. And that's why I took the job then, you know.
What was those first days like coming from the homestead and from the great hotels of Europe? I mean, what was this moving into a White House kitchen? What was that
very
like?
Very scary.
Yeah?
I was so scared, as a matter of fact, I was not talking to anybody. People thought I was a snob. They thought I was a snob. I said, this guy don't even look at you. You know why? I was terrorized. I was so afraid to make a mistake. I was so afraid that my stuff wouldn't come out okay. I had no time to look and chit-chat with people. I had no time because I was so concentrating. You don't know the effort it took me to make sure everything was 100% and plus, because I said, this is not the time to goof here, okay? So many, I know in kitchen, many times accidents happen or things don't turn out. Why? Because you don't concentrate.
You don't have your concentration.
Exactly. And this is when those things happen.
Right.
You have to be so focused like a laser on what you do, and you cannot have any interference.
Roland, we're going to, can you stay with us a little while? We're going to take a quick little break, and then we're going to come right back. You're such a great guest. I know all of our audience out there is sitting on the edge of their seat. Nobody says it, y'all, like Roland Mesnier. I love him to death. What a dear friend. Don't you dare go anywhere. This is just beginning.
John.
We'll be right back.
We had a letter from the president.
What's happening musically in Dakar? Joburg, Kinshasa, Port Spain, Havana, Accra, Dar es Salaam, Cairo, Paris, New York. Well, tune in this week and every week to find out on Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday night at 8 on KRVS.
Hi, everyone. This is Pat Mitchell-Whirley. Join us next time as we pull some historical recordings from our archives, and you'll hear from Furry Lewis, Sleepy John Estes, and Booker White. Feature host Robert Gordon will continue his look at the history of high records. That's all coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan.
Tonight at 11 on KRVS.
Comics avec Val. Bienvenue dans le monde francophone. C'est tous les jeudis à 9h sur KRVS, la radio Acadie.
You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, and on the web at krvs.org. Find us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.
America's president number one, founding father Washington, John Adams, second president, the very first White House resident.
Thomas Jefferson. Man, I need to hear all of that one, huh?
That was a good song, huh?
First one.
That's beautiful.
That's in your honor, Roland, right there. That's in your honor.
Oh, that's beautiful. I could listen to it all day.
Well, Slama won't let us do that. I mean, he's gonna shut us down, right? He doesn't like music. He shuts us down right away. On
well, get yeah, we gotta go, guys. We gotta roll. Radio to be made.
Anyway, Michelle, you had a question.
You know, I want to hear about the desserts, but first I want to hear about the dirt. Who was the hardest first lady to work for? Because you, let's see, you had Rosalind, you had Nancy, Barbara, Hillary, Laura.
Yeah. But let me tell you, probably the challenge I had was Mrs. Reagan, not because she was difficult, but because she was a perfectionist. Mm. Now, you have to understand, when the Reagan came to the White House, during the Carter year, the Carter never did very much with the House, if you will, and entertainment was not their main priority. But Mrs. Reagan wanted to make it so. She wanted to make it the finest establishment in the world. She wanted the finest food, the most beautiful table ever seen. Mrs. Reagan was all about perfection. And I tell you, I can give you a few clue on her perfection. That was amazing, the length that she would go to. And you know what? I thank her every day. She is a big part of my success today. She really showed me the way to perfection. She really did. She would accept nothing less but perfection. And that is a tough order. That's an order that some chef would not be able to take, okay? And she knew what she wanted, and she knew which road we were to take. And I say Mrs. Reagan would be the top of the five first lady I served.
That makes sense. I mean, she looks like a very elegant woman, and certainly she was coming from that California background. But yet at the same time, you could see that she wanted to put America first. No doubt about that. And then, of course, there was always the stories about President Reagan wanting to speak. Yes. He loved his chocolate. He loved his desserts, right? And she had to be careful.
Yes.
Now, those first days, you say, was very, very challenging. But then it didn't take you very long to get in there and fit in. Were you able to put your own team together, or did you have to take what they gave you? How did you build your team at the White House?
Well, you have to understand, when I came to the White House, very briefly, because that's interesting, I worked under the executive chef when I first came. But then that didn't work very well, you know. So I was able, after a few years, to get out of that and be my own executive pastry chef, okay? Not have to answer to the executive chef, but I would answer directly to either the usher's office, which is like the general manager's office, or the first lady. And that did much better with me, okay? And then later on, remember, I'm the chef that created the pastry shop in the White House. There was never a pastry shop.
Right, I remember.
When I came, I was working in the main kitchen with the chef, and that didn't work very well either. So I had to really play hardball with them to get my own pastry shop away from everything. And then later on, I opened a second room, which is called the chocolate room now in the White House, which is away from everything, where I did all the special function and chocolate work and sugar work and so on, away from the pastry shop where the production was done. So I'm the one who established all these in the White House that did not exist before. So I want to make sure people understand that, you know, because people sometimes try to steal stuff from me, you know, which is not nice. Some naughty, naughty people, you know.
I remember the first real tour I had of the White House in the kitchens. I was so fortunate I met you then. That was the first time I met you, and you were so proud of you. Oh, my God, you were so proud, and rightfully so, that you had gotten the pastry kitchen and you had gotten it together.
Yes.
I don't know if you had the chocolate room yet, but oh, my God, I'll never forget coming back to Louisiana. And of everything I had done at that time, I was so proud to have met Roland Mesnier and to talk with you. And then you and I later were so fortunate to get our honorary doctorate together from Johnson and Wales. So we got to meet again. And what a nice history we have together. Now again, getting back to the staff, after the Reagans, the pastry, of course, was now elevated in the White House with you. What did your staff and your duties look like at that point? How did it grow from the beginning to this point?
Yes. So also when I came to the White House, you have to understand also 50 to 60% or even more of a lot of baked goods were bought in bakery around town. They were not even baked in the White House kitchen. So one of my goals was to eliminate all that. I wanted that whatever the guests get at the White House was baked in the White House, nowhere else. That took me a little bit of doing because of the staff. You know, remember when I started in the White House, I had no staff. I was it. One guy, me, for everything. And that was a very, very big load because I had nobody to help. Then later on, 5, 6, or 7 years later, they allowed a part-time person to come and help me for a few hours a day. And then it grew later on to have a full-time assistant much farther. That was during the Clinton administration, so you talk quite a few years after, where I had a full-time assistant, you see. And then some part-time people. But all my career at the White House, I did with one assistant only and using part-time people from hotel and restaurant around town.
So kind of what was a typical day? I mean, you started at what time? What did you do first?
I used to arrive at the White House around 6:30 in the morning. And when would I leave? I don't know. Whenever the job was done. You know, many times I would leave the White House at 11 o'clock at night. And be back the next day by 6:30. Or sometimes I would be lucky, maybe the family was traveling or something. Then by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I could go home. But there were very few of those days. So there was no typical day. You know, at the White House, you may have come to work one day, and the first function of the day would have been a breakfast for 400 people.
A small breakfast.
Yeah, small breakfast. Having the pastry shop was responsible for making all the Danish and all the sweets for that, of course. Mm-hmm. Then that may be it for the day. Or maybe then the next function will be an afternoon tea for 300-400 people on the same day.
Goodness.
And then maybe later on there will be a dinner with the president, first lady, maybe a dozen people or maybe 200 people. You don't know, you see.
Wow.
So you don't have one day. The day... They were following each other, but never the same. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You did not know what could come during that day. You know, in the middle of the day, they could say, oh, gee, we forgot to tell you. The king who is coming for dinner tonight has his birthday tonight. So we're talking about a king, okay? So guess what? You better start to put your thinking cap and what do I do and how do I do and what the... You know, I mean, he has to be a cake fit for a king. That's what I'm trying to say.
Plus, it probably had to have the country's traditions and everything.
Oh, yes.
My God, I can't even
imagine. Definitely. You have to find out if you were correct or not on what ingredient to use and what design and, you know, so on. And so you had to be right on the hop on everything. So this is, yeah, it was a very, very... exciting job somehow that I still miss today, I must say, because the excitement and the challenge, I love challenge. A day without challenge for me is like a day without sun, you know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
I do not like a day where you pump out 1,000 cookies. Well, you know, of course you can jazz up the cookies, but as far as you can go.
There's a difference between saying do 1,000 chocolate chip cookies or the king is coming for his birthday.
Yes, yes, yes.
Now, there's a beautiful picture on your website of Mr. and Mrs. Clinton, the president smiling, looking at this big, beautiful table of sweets that you've prepared. Now, there's all the stories, you know, because President Clinton certainly loved his sweets. Was there constant challenges between all the different first families or the where you had to always be constantly aware of whether this one could have this or that one could have that or that?
Yes.
What were some of those challenges you had?
Especially with President Clinton, he was allergic to chocolate, dairy products, and flour.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah, and he loved dessert. He loved sweets. So I tell you what, there was, I scratched my head many, many times what I'm going to do, but, you know, I was able to put together a very nice repertoire of a lot of dessert that he really, really enjoyed. And one of his famous favorite one was my peach and blackberry cobbler. You know, being a southerner, you know, peaches is always a win-win situation. And then blackberry, and then of course I did my cobbler totally different from the cobbler, you know. I try to avoid a lot of sugar in my dessert. I like to eat sweet, but not too sweet. I find most of the dessert too sweet for my taste. And that was one of the desserts. And another one was the special strawberry cake that was done just for him. An exceptionally good cake. Again, that fit right in his diet. And he just loved dessert. And every night I had to come up with something different, something that he would enjoy. And then we had other president with family member that also had allergy. So you have to stay with that, you know. Yeah, really had to.
You have to be aware. Well, you know, it dawned on me as we were talking just now. It dawned on me that I had a great fortune, first and foremost, to meet President Reagan, and of course, I was with the Reagans at the Gorbachev summit in Moscow because I did my restaurant in '88, and of course, the Reagans were there when I did my restaurant for the summit. And then, of course, I got a chance to cook for the presidents as well on the road. You were doing desserts at the White House, but President Clinton, when you were saying just now he had a flour allergy, it reminds me how many times when he came to Louisiana and I did things for him over at the governor's mansion that the first thing he asked for was a roast pork po' boy on a nice French bread. I'm wondering how he got past that.
Well, you know, John, he did not respect anything about that. He did not care. I had the same situation when he could not have chocolate. We know that. And if somebody requested the chocolate cake for some reason, so I'll make the chocolate cake, but I always had a special cake for the president ready on the plate. And if I was in the dining room cutting the cake, he would be coming to me, said, okay, Roland, give me a piece of cake. I said, Mr. President, no, here is your cake. This is the one you... I don't want that. Give me a piece of chocolate cake. I say, sir, you cannot have chocolate cake. He said, says who? I am the president of the United States, and I want chocolate cake. I said, sir, there it is. How big do you want it? Just tell me. So I would put a pound of chocolate cake on his plate. I thought to myself, knock yourself out. Okay. And you know, I still know today when Bill has been a very bad boy. Because when he's been into something he's not supposed to, he's got those bags under his eyes the following day. Even today, when I see him on TV, I tell my wife, I said, I think Billy has been a bad boy last night. Just take a look.
Well, that's really funny. And I remember the last dinner I did for George Bush Jr. was in New Orleans. And I'll never forget, the White House said, and he doesn't like sweets too much. And I'm thinking to myself, I know Roland had to make
good sweets. You see, John, I'm sorry to cut you. This is not true.
I know it's not true.
This is typical of these people that travel with the president. They want to come to you so that you will believe that they're big and they know everything. And they totally steer you in the wrong direction. You know how many times I had the thing happen to me? They would say, oh, don't give that to the president. He don't like it. And then I would give it, and the president said, oh, my God, this was so good. Please, I want it again.
Well, that's what I was going to tell you. I did, on that last dinner I did for President Bush in New Orleans, I did an individual little red velvet cake for this, because the table had requested this. And somebody from the staff said, don't worry about the dessert for the president. They'll put it on the table. And 5 minutes later, they come back, Roland, and they said, the president loved the cake. He'd like another piece.
Of course. Yes, that's typical.
Now, let me ask you one last question before we go, because I know you have to go too. You know, there's a new movie out right now called The Butler.
Yes.
I don't know if you've seen the movie or
not.
Oh,
yes. Oh, yes.
How accurate is that, huh?
Okay, John, let me tell you, The Butler, I had the honor and the privilege to work with this gentleman for 7 years. The real butler.
Right.
His name is Gene Allen.
Right.
And he was absolutely the best. This man was the top. And I got so excited when I found out they were going to make a movie out of him, because I said, you know what? I want every young people in this country that are in the food business to watch this film, to see how proud, how hard of a worker he was, how nice he was and everything. I said, that's good. And when I went to see the movie, I was so upset when I came out. They used my friend Gene Allen to promote one of their things, and that I don't like, okay? That I don't like. Gene never was part of any political thing while he was in the White House, and he was in the White House 40 years.
Wow.
But, half of the story they show with that, it's wrong.
You know, I never saw the movie yet, but I heard a bunch of people say that there may have been some issues, and I know you knew him very well.
Big issue. John, I bumped into a lot of former waiter and butler from the White House that knew Gene, and they all say the same thing.
Well, I knew you would have a comment about it, because I knew I knew you knew him well.
Roland,
we are so happy that you were with us on the show today. I can't thank you enough for the time you spent with us. My God, you were so generous with your time, and I know the day is going to come when we can do something together again.
John,
You're so busy, but thank you so much.
You will get there,
I know. And thank you, and Michelle is sitting here saying goodbye as well.
Yeah, thanks again, Roland.
No, I thank you. I thank you for inviting me in your show. It is always a pleasure anytime, okay?
Well, we appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Good. We'll see you soon. All right, y'all. I tell you what, Michelle, do we have a...
Roland Mesnier's books will be
all,
on the
all
website.
All the President's Pastries, 25 years at the White House, as well as Dessert University.
We'll put a surprise recipe on there, too.
Absolutely, we will. A couple of them. Y'all, we'll see you next week.
Our music on the Thistle and Shamrock transcends boundaries, expands horizons, celebrates tradition, stimulates innovation. It's music to bring people together, so why don't you join us?
Coming up Sunday evening at 6, here on KRVS.
In every Saturday night at midnight for The Diamond Sea, a weekly mixtape featuring the best in independent music from the 80s, 90s, and today. Here on 88.7 KRVS, public radio for Acadiana.
Hey, this is Dallas Green from City & Color inviting you to visit E-Town this week. I'll be joined by Nick and Helen and the winner of the E-Achievement Award. That's this week in E-Town.
Tuesday at noon on KRVS.
Public Radio for Acadiana, KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.